Illinois Department of Corrections. Ms. Gibney. Ms. Gibney, come in.
May it please the court. Defendant's entire case that Carol did not exhaust his administrative remedies boils down to their claim that Carol fled himself out of court by alleging facts in the complaint that supposedly showed a failure to exhaust. According to the defendants, when requested, an inmate is required to appear before the Administrative Review Board for the Department of Corrections in order to exhaust his administrative remedies. The defendants then claim that Carol alleged in his complaint that he refused to appear before the ARB, and therefore the district court properly disregarded Carol's subsequent sworn statements that he did not refuse to appear, because those statements supposedly contradict the allegations in Carol's complaint. The defendants are mistaken. As this court has held on several occasions, a plaintiff is not required to anticipate a defendant's exhaustion defense in their complaint, but rather is permitted to add by affidavit or brief essential facts to refute that defense, so long as those facts are consistent with the complaint. And this is exactly what Carol attempted to do here. He provided sworn statements in response to defendant's motion to dismiss, which established that he exhausted his administrative remedies. Specifically, he provided sworn statements that he did not refuse to appear and that he was never informed about the arbitration panel's hearing. So the defendant's argument that Carol's sworn statements should be disregarded because they contradict the allegations in the complaint would make sense but for one problem. Carol never alleged in his complaint or anywhere else that he refused to appear before the ARB. So there is no conflict between Carol's sworn statements in response to the motion to dismiss and the complaint that he filed. The portion of the complaint in which the defendants claim that Carol alleged that he refused to appear is a copy of the meeting minutes of the ARB, which is an attachment to Carol's complaint. And that attachment states that the panel was advised by Menard Correctional Center staff D.O. Meyer that inmate Carol refused to appear before the Administrative Review Board. Now, Carol never conceded that C.O. Meyer's alleged representation to the ARB was true. Carol was attaching the arbitration meeting minutes to his complaint because it was the very decision he was appealing, not because he agreed with its content or that he was somehow using it to support his case. The arbitration meeting minutes represented the prison official's position in this matter, not Carol's. But the defendants, and apparently the district court, imputed the prison official's position to Carol simply because he attached it to his complaint. But it's ridiculous to conclude that every time a plaintiff attaches a portion of the administrative record to his complaint, that he's now conceding all those facts. That's akin to saying that an appellant concedes the contents of a district court order he's appealing simply because he's attached the order to his appeal. In fact, under the defendant's logic, the statements made by prison officials in their incident reports that they did not use excessive force against Carol would have also been considered alleged by Carol because he also attached those incident reports to his complaint. But that's clearly not the case. Carol attached the incident reports for the very same reason he attached the arbitration panel's meeting minutes, to provide the court with a complete record of the proceedings below. The bottom line is that Carol provided unrefuted sworn testimony that he did not receive notice of the arbitration hearing.
What did Judge Gilbert mean when he said, I'm looking at page A13, that even if Carol had been unaware of the ARB hearing, his need to attend, he certainly received a copy of the minutes, which the board clearly stated that it did not make a determination of the merits of his grievance. That notice alone should have prompted Carol to understand the need to pursue the remaining steps of administrative review.
Well, that that sentence in the order is problematic merely because it doesn't make sense, because at that stage there were no further steps of administrative review. So it doesn't make sense to say he should have gone back and done something else, because the administrative rules do not provide for him to do anything after the ARB. After the ARB has a hearing, the very next step is to appeal to the district court, which is exactly what Carroll did. And
Well, he's filed 75. How long has he been in prison?
I can't tell you that.
75 grievances, and he's had to attend, at least according to his testimony, he's only had to attend once.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's correct.
And the prison does not have, I take it, a Chicken Little rule that after you cry the sky is falling a certain number of times, they tune out?
I don't think they do, and I don't think they could. As long as he's stated a claim upon...
Well, I don't know whether you say you don't think they could. We do. After you filed 3 frivolous complaints, the federal judiciary tunes out, or at least it requires payment up front.
Well, the case law in this state and from this circuit is that as long as you state a claim upon relief can be granted, you can't be thrown out of court. And in this case, he certainly has, regardless of how many grievances he may or may not have filed. And this circuit
has
also...
At least he has not struck out under the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
The 75 strike rule.
Yeah.
His last chance. Want to save the rest of your time, or do you have something further?
I just have a few more comments.
Okay.
I guess bottom line of what I'm saying here is that the allegations in Carroll made that he did not receive notice of the ARB hearing do not contradict his complaint and establish that he did exhaust his administrative remedies. And so the district court erred in disregarding them. And in addition... In addition, for reversing on that ground, this court can also reverse on 2 other grounds, although the court does not necessarily need to address them. Both of those were also addressed in my brief. First, that the administrative rules do not require inmates to personally appear before the ARB in order to exhaust their administrative remedies. And in fact, the defendants even concede that on pages 19 through 20 of their brief. And secondly, the defendants waived their exhaustion defense on at least 2 occasions. First, when they failed to object to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. And secondly, when they didn't raise...
Was the claim of waiver itself presented in a timely fashion? That is, when the state makes its post-Perez argument, was a response made that claim had been waived or forfeited?
Carroll raised his waiver argument at the very first time he could in his response to the defendant's motion to reconsider. And at that time, he may not have articulated it the best that he could, but he did mention that the defendants had waited over a year and a half and that their claim was just filed too late, or their argument was just filed too late. And he also raised it more specifically in his motion to vacate.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gibbons.
Thank you.
Mr. Barrow?
May it please the court, counsel Brian Barrow, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the defendants, appellees in this case. The plaintiff does characterize the dispute in this case correctly. This is a case, our position is that Mr. Carroll has simply pled himself out of court. While Rule 8 provides limited...
Well,
how did he do that?
Yeah, where is the allegation in his complaint that he refused to participate?
He does
Your
not
brief says that his complaint contains such an allegation. I've read the complaint. I can't find it. What am I missing?
I think you have to look at the... If you look at the ARB decision, what he said... Well,
that's what the defendant's position is. But where does he allege in his complaint that he refused to participate?
What he says in his complaint is he exhausted. He does not. He's silent on any on whether he participated or didn't participate.
Look, your brief says correct. That he affirmatively alleges in his complaint that he refused to participate.
No,
so you should be prepared to show where he so alleges.
I think what my brief says is that What the ARB found is that he refused to participate.
No, that's not what your brief
says.
Your brief says that he alleged this affirmatively in his complaint.
The ARB decision is the allegation of his complaint.
No, it's not.
Yes,
it is the decision under attack.
But it's
no more the allegation of the complaint than is the decision of the National Labor Relations Board when an employer comes here and says they fouled up. One does not concede an administrative decision when one attacks the administrative decision.
This is not administrative review, Your Honor. This is an exhaustive requirement to get into court to file a civil action for an Eighth Amendment violation.
Look, the message you're giving me is I just can't trust what's in the brief filed by the state of Illinois in these kinds of cases.
I think if I can have a moment to explain.
We use words in kind of humpty-dumpty fashion. We don't use them in normal fashion. We just make up new meanings for the words and put them in our briefs.
No, Your Honor.
Well, that just tells me I can't believe your briefs, counsel.
Here's what Mr. Carroll alleged. If you look at Section C, it's Essay 13, he says, what steps did you take to exhaust? File grievance. Okay, so he's alleging he exhausted his administrative remedies.
Yes.
This is his requirement under the law. He has to allege. He attaches the ARB decision to show that he exhausted the administrative remedies. What the ARB decision says is he did not exhaust his administrative remedies. These are the allegations you have to take as true. He cannot, this court has made clear, he cannot turn around and contradict these allegations by briefs in his motion to dismiss. This is no different than the Thompson case where the plaintiff attached the job description and then contradicted what the job description said. Now, our position is that it's not enough.
We have cases that say you don't necessarily adopt the attachments you attach to your complaint.
I understand that, Your Honor.
And at all events, candid advocacy compelled you to make clear what you were actually arguing.
I believe
one doesn't say, if what you mean is we're contending that you adopt whatever you attach to your complaint, you do not say in your brief, the defendant affirmatively alleged refusal to cooperate.
I believe that is our position. Our position is that the ARB decision, the finding that he did refuse to, is
I don't know
fact.
Why you want to induce us to disbelieve what you say. If that's your objective, well, I'm capable of learning.
Your Honor, I do not believe.
The alternative is to fall on your sword, and since you seem unwilling to do that, I have to draw inferences.
Well, I think the reasonable inferences that we drew from the allegations, from the detachment of the ARB decision, is that he was not coming to that hearing. That's what the ARB affirmatively found, that he had refused to come. This, because this is necessary to support his complaint, is the allegation of his complaint. And
well, what he said was there was no purpose for his coming because, everything he had to say was set out and... was set out in his papers. Why would he think that an unsatisfactory response? They didn't say you have to come and testify live.
They did ask him to come and testify.
What did they say exactly?
They asked him to come and Mr. Carroll is not personally interviewed by the board.
You have to speak up. I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, Ron. I'm looking for the actual reference in the ARB decision. The panel was advised by Menard Correctional Center.
I can't hear you. You're mumbling.
The panel was advised by the Menard Correctional Center staff that inmate Carroll refused to appear before the Administrative Review Board on the above date.
Yes, but first of all, we don't know if that's true. But secondly, that's very ambiguous, right? I mean, you could say, would you like to appear and give live testimony? And he says, no, I don't want to appear. There's no need for it. And that might weaken his case and so on if he didn't do that. But that's not necessarily disobeying someone's order.
But the board did it. It found that the case was moot.
Is there anywhere in the record that tells us what this guard said? Did the guard file an affidavit saying, here's what I said?
No.
And here's what he said, or anything like that?
There's nothing like that. But what the board found, it didn't decide the case on the merits. It found the decision moot. It found it did not have enough information to render a decision. Because remember, this was a case of excessive force. It was a swearing match between the guard and the prisoner. And they want to see what, I mean, it was understandable, they want to see what Mr. Carroll would say.
Then why didn't you defend it on the merits rather than getting into all this exhaustion business?
Because exhaustion was is a requirement under the law. He has to exhaust his administrative remedy.
Yes, I know, but you don't have to argue exhaustion. You can always say, look, we're not going to get into this briar patch.
Well,
the claim has no merit and therefore was properly dismissed.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I mean, this court has made
a very weak exhaustion argument here.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, I mean, this court has made it clear that exhaustion is required. We file a motion to dismiss.
That's such a nebulous way to put it. Exhaustion is required. Exhaustion is, yes, exhaustion is a requirement, but as a defendant, you don't have to stake your all on showing that there wasn't exhaustion. You
it's
can
an affirmative
say,
defense.
Yeah,
you can
right.
waive affirmative defenses.
Correct, correct. We could waive,
yeah.
Which is, I know, is one of the arguments they bring.
So instead of the way you present it now, you have a great argument on the merits. Instead of doing that, you give us a really feeble argument about exhaustion.
Well, Your Honor, the case, I mean,
really bad.
I mean, Your Honor, this was the, I mean, the, you know, this was a decision made in light of Perez to come to re-raise the exhaustion argument. I think we were perfectly appropriate to do so.
I mean, you realize that just what the board said, the guard said, is not going to throw his case out. So you try to get around that by having him endorse what the guard said in his complaint. That's very unrealistic.
Well, you're right. That's our position. I don't.
But that gets back to the question. We have cases which say you can't do that.
But Your Honor, I believe there's also cases that say you can't contradict the allegations of your complaint.
The allegations of the complaint.
Right. And I think
we come back to the fact that it's not the allegations.
But
the
attachments to the.
But you're living in a Humpty Dumpty world.
Your Honor,
and it just doesn't befit the state of Illinois
to
play games in this fashion.
The attachment to his complaint under the rule are part of the allegations of the complaint. He's required to.
But look, think about it. Suppose a person sues for breach of contract. So he attaches the contract to his complaint. Does that mean that he certifies that everything stated in that contract is truthful?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean,
well, how is this different?
This court has made it clear.
How is this different?
Well, it's different because, as the cases have said, there's a difference between fleshing out the allegations of your complaint.
Wait a second. Look, very simple proposition. If you attach the contract to your breach of contract complaint, does that ipso facto certify that you believe that everything in the contract is correctly stated?
It's going to be kind of
yes or no.
It will not. But it will
yes
not.
Or
no.
No,
it will,
please.
It does not. It will not. Okay.
Okay. So how is this different?
Because in this complaint, this is part of his cause of action. That's the difference between your hypothetical.
What's part of his cause
in other
of
words,
action?
Or his, I'm sorry, not part of his cause of action. It's part of the. He has to plead exhaustion on the face of his complaint.
No, he doesn't.
Okay. That's what
exhaustion
the case
is. Exhaustion is an affirmative defense.
But in Massey, this court
look,
said we.
Counsel, I don't understand your strategy. Maybe I should just give up. But there are plain legal rules about this. One does not have to plead around exhaustion. It's an affirmative defense. Affirmative defenses do not have to be anticipated in the complaint. The Supreme Court so held in a case called Gomez against Toledo. And believe it or not, we're going to follow the Supreme Court.
I understand that, Your Honor. But in Massey, this court also said that if exhaustion is not clear on the face of the complaint, a motion to dismiss is proper. And
oh, sure. That's true with all affirmative defenses. Like, you bring a suit and you say that 300 years ago, the defendant stole my watch. Now, even though statute of limitations is affirmative defense, you can look at the complaint and say, look, this is obviously time-barred. I'm going to dismiss on the basis of statute of limitations. That's fine. If it's obvious from the complaint that there's an affirmative defense, yes, the court can dismiss on that basis. But the only way you try to make it obvious is by saying that somehow he certifies what this guard said.
I don't think you're necessarily certifying what the guard said. I think you're certifying what the ARB found, which is that he refused to appear.
No, but the ARB, it found it on the basis of what a guard told it.
Right.
If the guard was misinformed it, then its decision collapses. Right?
Right.
So how do we know what the guard actually said? Now, what you're saying is, well, the reason we know it is that Carroll has said, in effect, the guard told the truth. That's what your argument comes down to. It's so ridiculous.
Well, we disagree, Your Honor. I think.
Well, you concede that not every attachment to a complaint is endorsed by the
Not necessarily. If there are facts contradicting in the complaint, sure.
Well, not facts, but there's a certain way you analyze it, and we're required to analyze it, whether or not it's an endorsement of what's in the attachment, right?
For example, I mean, we're not obviously the reports of the his father's complaint. He has his grievances, and there's certainly fact. The complaint itself raises fact as to what actually happened. We're not suggesting that the statements of the guards are somehow admissions on his part as to what actually
really?
Happened. Right, but they are because
if they're not, I don't know where your case is. I thought that was your whole point. He admitted the guard's truthfulness. Otherwise, we don't know whether he refused to appear.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm talking about the actual events, the underlying events itself. I mean, the other.
Well, why is he believed for what he told the board, but not for the underlying events?
He's never contradicted them. He never contradicted them until the briefing on his motion to dismiss.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Farrell. Ms. Gibney, how much time does she have? 2 minutes?
Unless there are any questions, I have nothing else to add.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Gibney. And you were asked to represent Mr. Carroll, were you not?
Yes.
Well, we thank you very much for your opportunity.